nothing under the sun is new, as you know, as they say. But so consult with us, like ask us, like, well, how would you have done it? Would you have done it differently? You know, like, and you have room to make mistakes, but we're here, like we're there. Use us as a resource. And so whenever a low point comes up, you know, like, okay, well, how did you handle that particular low point? And so, and it opens up the conversation. And then we kind of like pull the table, if you will, right? Like we're sitting in like at a round table, and it's kind of, and everybody kind of gives a small little, it's like, oh yeah, you know, I like that approach. That would have been more effective. Or so the kids are slowly learning that it's okay to fail. And nothing comes out of failure except how you get up and you go again and you try it again and you do something differently the next time, and the result might be different.
My name is Tim Anderson. Welcome to Father and Friend, where men learn to live for the good of their families.
Today, we're with Yusuf Farag. He is a former healthcare entrepreneur turned psychotherapist, executive coach, and author. With over a decade of experience, he helps leaders and professionals thrive under pressure. He combines his clinical insights, his leadership strategies, and his faith-based wisdom. He's the author of Godly Manhood, and he works with individuals and organizations to build emotional strength, resilience, and purpose-driven leadership. But today, Yusuf is a father of two and has a wife, and we're going to talk about fatherhood. So, Yusuf, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Well, it's good to be here, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Would you take the pleasure of telling us about some of the most impactful life events that have shaped who you are?
You know,
and I'd love for you to talk about the one we just talked about.
For sure. So I think what we were talking about, Tim, is kind of like my running away with the family, like escaping for our life. So I was born in Sudan. I'm a Coptic Christian. For those who don't know, the Coptic Church is the Church of Alexandria, one of the oldest apostolic churches in the world. We have our own Pope, not the Catholic Pope, right? It's very, very different. But anyways, so I was born in Sudan, and around the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, there was a change in government where the military overthrew the existing government and took over. And unfortunately, it was an Islamic kind of like military rule. And as Christians, it was very hard for us to kind of just live. And I remember as a child in grade four, you know, having to kind of defend my faith at school, because like my friends at the time would come up to me and are like, oh, you're Christian, you don't belong in this country, you know, you should convert to Islam. So it had trickled down. It was not just on adult level, but at that point, and I remember this, and my parents at the time decided, you know, this is not a good place for us to grow up. And they went through the whole process, applied for immigration to Canada. And now the only problem is when the immigration papers kind of came, was getting out of the country. It was illegal to leave the country with your money. So throughout the period of like 2-3 years, the bulk of our money was, we were able to like transfer it to accounts overseas. But I do remember very vividly the night that we were leaving. First, we had to get like this permission slip to be on the road because there was like a curfew. And so we had to get a permission slip in order to drive to the airport. Our flight was leaving at 10 PM, something like that. And, it was in the middle, it was in the middle of summer. And I see my mother is wearing her fur coat at the time, and she's wearing like a big like chain, like gold necklace thing, whatever. It's trying to move that out of the country. And I was 10 at the time, my brother would have been 3. She puts both on us some rings, she puts on us like necklaces, like it's all like all ways of moving. And we get to the airport and we're frisked and we're searched and you know, making sure that you know we're not carrying anything, because if we were caught moving our money out, the penalty was execution. We got onto the flight. As soon as the flight took off, my mother leaned into my father. She said, "That went very well, don't you think?" And he said, "Let's not talk about it ever again." And she said, "Just FYI, I was holding $10,000 in my hand." And, you know, never knew my mother to be, you know, a risky individual like that. It was over 10,000 Sudanese pounds at the time, right? It was like, you know, like maybe equivalent of $100 or something like that, right? But it was still, and I remember like in the 14-hour flight, you know, it was like, my father is like, "What is wrong with you? You risked your life for that." But you know, she's like, "We're here, we're okay. Let's just, you know." And we got to Edmonton in Canada. And if anybody also doesn't know much about the geography, Edmonton is very north. It's one of the coldest places in Canada. And when we moved, we moved kind of in, I think it was February. And so we moved from like plus 30 to minus 30, 35, minus 40 over, you know, a 14-hour span. And it was a bit of a shock to the system, if you will.
Yeah, that's going to be, 100 Fahrenheit down to basically negative temperatures.
It was a shock, I have to say. And I don't think we had jackets, but we did have cousins that met us at the airport who brought jackets for us. My mother had her fur coat, so she was fine, right? When we first moved, there was an existing Coptic church, but it wasn't fully established. And when I say fully established, is that there wasn't a full-time priest that was assigned to the church. And so services were sporadic. You know, we kind of attended, you know, once a month when the Pope from, you know, Alexandria would send a priest to kind of celebrate some kind of a feast with us. Or if somebody from, I currently live in Toronto, so somebody, there's a lot of churches in Toronto established already. If there's an additional priest that they would send for us and would pray on a Saturday, not even a Sunday. So it was very sporadic. Sunday school wasn't a thing, you know, and whatnot. But the church became like a tether to the culture, more so than just a place of worship or for us to practice our faith. Eventually, by the time that I was, I'd say 12, there was a priest that was assigned permanently for the church, and services became more frequent and every Sunday. And my parents were really focused on that. You know, Sunday is the Lord's day. We go, we pray together. We attend Sunday school. It was a long, prolonged day. Like liturgies in the Coptic church are about 3 hours, 3 to 4 hours, right? We celebrate the Eucharist every Sunday. But you can imagine like a typical 12-year-old who hadn't really, you know, been practicing for it. It's not a habit yet. It was always, every Sunday was a struggle with my dad. I'm like, every Sunday he would like, church would start at 8. So he would come like at 7 o'clock and he'd, you know, like wake me up and like, you know, come on, let's go. We got to go. And I'm like, dad, I don't want to, this and that. And it's a struggle and a struggle and a struggle. And with a fight every Sunday, I would still go and I would be like miserable and sad and whatever. This is the point that I want to kind of get to. This is the point that really, really shaped my walk with Christ. When I was 13, my father came into my room on a typical Sunday. He had this really kind of annoying way of waking me up. He would like, you know, very subtly sneak into the room, turn on the light, sit on the side of my bed, and he would put his finger on my nose. And if I don't move, he would kind of like shake his finger slightly, like a little bit, you know? And he's like, "All right, it's Sunday, let's go." And, you know, I braced for the fight and like, I'm like, you know, I don't want to, whatever. And I don't know what was different about that day, but he said to me very clearly, he's like, "I'm going to make you a deal. Today, I want you to come stand right next to me, but really open up your heart and just listen, observe, and really engage. If by the end of that liturgy, you decide the church is not for you and you never want to attend again, I'm not going to ask you." Mm. So at the age of 13, he kind of gave me that choice, that freedom to choose. And I remember like, yeah, sure, whatever, you know, like I'll take you on, but I really adhered to it. I went and I stood beside him and I really like paid attention and I focused and I listened and for the first moment, Tim, I can't explain this. I sobbed. Mm. I cried. Mm. It really, really like hit me, the weight of what it is that I was participating in, what I was standing and observing and partaking. And I remember looking up at him and he just grinned at me with that, you know, kind of like, I told you so, kind of a moment. Mm. And for me, that was the moment that I chose Christ. That was the moment that just opened up my heart to all of this. And it flooded. And the tears were not just like of the weight of it, but it was the tears of kind of like regret of like, I've missed out on all of this. Mm. I'm now my son is 12 years old.
Mm. You're about to enter that phase, that same moment.
And the struggle is real. The struggle is, and we have been like, since they were born, my kids, we've been in the church on every Sunday. We're there, you know, every Friday night, there is some hymns class. There's some service for the kids where we try and get them engaged. Every Sunday, it's still a struggle to get my son up. He has no problem waking up on a Saturday at 6:45 in the morning to like game with his friends, right? But getting up on Sunday, it's like, come on, buddy, let's go. We got to do this. And the one thing that I learned from my dad is the patience, is that the gentleness of it. Like I, you know, I'm just like any typical dad. Like I have my moments where, you know, like I yell at the top of my lungs, you know, like, let's go, we're late, we're running, let's go. Right. And I, last year I got a speeding ticket on a Sunday because we were late. The cop pulls us over. He's like, what's the hurry? I'm like, we're late for church. So you can imagine like it can be stressful. Right. But I've really, that's the one thing that I can say I've learned is that when it comes to the church, it has to be with gentleness and it has to be with the absolute Christ-like love that he just waiting, that patience. I'm, you know, in Revelations, I'm standing, knocking at the door, waiting for you to let me in.
Yeah.
Right. And that's the message that I have kind of tried to impart on my children.
Mm. That's really special. I imagine a lot of men have experienced something of the opposite, you know, the I'm frustrated, I'm upset, I'm not waiting, hurry up, let's get this thing together, buddy, you know. Yeah. And so that's a really special thing that your dad passed down to you. I think that, you know, like you said, even if it's not perfect, the idea that you have that in your mind to go, yes, being Christ-like and gentle, that is something I've seen and something, yeah, I know what it looks like.
Yeah.
And that's really fantastic. So when we spoke before this, thank you for sharing that story. That's fantastic. So when we spoke before this, we talked about one of the things that you do in your family, and you mentioned that you have dinner every night together, or you have dinner together every night of the week.
Yep.
Tell me how that started, what that looks like, what you do. Give me the play-by-play.
Yeah, sure. No. So when my wife and I first got married, you know, every like couple goes through that, like, you know, our day is like the most special. Nobody else like has that day whatsoever. When we went on our honeymoon, the resort that we were staying at, everybody was celebrating their wedding weekend, which was like the same day as ours. And so it was kind of, the irony was fantastic. They, you know, they play games in the resort. And one of the games that they were playing was the newlywed games. And one of the couples that was there has been married for like, I don't know, like 30, 40 years or something like that. And so they were celebrating their anniversary weekend. So they brought them up on stage, that couple. And I remember they asked the husband, they said, what is your secret to the longevity of your marriage? What is the secret to your success or to your happiness? And without skipping a beat, he said, we have dinner together every night. And that really kind of like stuck with me, right? Because there's so much that needs to happen for just that simple act to occur, right? I have to create that.
I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
No, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Space as a sacred space, right? It's a time where my wife and I will come and sit together and engage about our day, right? If we're in an argument, we have to resolve that before dinner time. Right? So that we can sit down and you know, have dinner together. If we're tired or exhausted, we have whatever. Everything else has to kind of be put aside or resolved just for that simple act of dinner, right? And God bless my wife. She is a whiz. Within half an hour, like, things can go from the freezer onto like the dinner table, and it tastes immaculate and amazing. And I'm like, how did you make this? She's like, I don't know. Like, I threw a bunch of stuff together, right? That's a blessing that she's received that nobody else, like, I feel like I anyways. I digress.
No, I was going to say that, you know, all the things you mentioned that have to get done, never mind actually making the meal,
right?
Sitting down. Yeah.
Listen, I've tried to help out and it's not a skill that my mother taught me or my, but up until like my father passed away, if he could boil an egg, that was like a lifetime accomplishment. Like, that was an accolade. Like, he's like, look, I boiled an egg. Right. So it's not something that I learned or excel in any way. I've tried to make dinner multiple times. It's like a week long process, like, where I'm like, I need these ingredients, I need to follow this recipe, and then eventually something like along the way gets messed up, and then my wife comes to the rescue. So it's better off just kind of like leaving it to her. But that's where it all started, was from that moment of our honeymoon, is to dinner together is a time for the two of us to kind of like just talk about our day, to just engage, like, what are our highs, what are our lows, you know, that it's a point of connection. And when we had our kids, that expanded to them. Now that my kids are, you know, 12 and 9, you know, like, the questions of like, how is school, is always met with fine, good. I'm like, okay, let's start. So I've learned to ask around those kind of questions.
Yeah, right? Tell me how you navigate those, because I know that I've experienced something similar in my own family, and dinner becomes an
interrogation.
It becomes a strange interrogation where I'm like, I'm just trying to have a conversation, but for whatever reason, it doesn't feel like that, you know?
Yeah. So we start off kind of like very slowly with, you know, let's set the table together, you know, let's work through that. And like, you go take this, you take care of that, you do whatever. We have a small little 6-pound dog that is a social eater. She will not eat until we are sitting down at the table. So somebody has to go get the dog, and then somebody has to prep the dog's food, and then like put it beside one of the chairs, and like, then we'll sit down. And we'll always pray. There's always a prayer before the meal.
Do you guys pray a liturgical prayer, or is that, I don't know if that's a Coptic tradition.
So there's this small, like, little kind of like, you know, God bless this food that is before us and the hands that made it. And here's when we pray. And then we go into the Lord's Prayer. Mm-hmm. So that's, the Lord's Prayer is always, sort of a seal, the deal, seal any kind of a prayer. So you finish off any prayers in the church with the Lord's Prayer.
Now I know in the Orthodox Church, they often sing the Lord's Prayer. Is that also a Coptic tradition, or do you say it?
No, that's an Eastern Orthodox tradition. In the Coptic Church, we usually say it, but there are times where it is sung in Coptic, not in English or Arabic, which is an influential language in the culture. But no, we, for the most time, we just say it.
Okay.
And then we kind of like, I'm like, oh, so sweetheart. Like I start off the conversation and I ask my wife, I kind of like prime my children with like examples. Like, I'm like, how was your day? And so like my wife, you know, gives me details and tells me like, you know, about her day. And then I kind of like, okay, well, that's pretty cool. And I offer some kind of an insight. And I ask the kids, I'm like, what do you guys think? Like what mom did, like, is that like, what would you have done the same thing in her place? Or would you do something differently? So I get them kind of engaged in that kind of a conversation. And then sometimes, you know, my daughter is the younger one. So she's like let's bring it on, right? Like, so she's ready to share. And she's like, yeah, today, whatever I had. So tell me about your day, sweetheart. And then she's like, oh, it was fun. We had a brain break. I'm like, what's a brain break? That's the only thing I hear. She's in grade 4, like brain break. I'm like, what's a brain break? Or our teacher, like, you know, thought we were studying too hard. So we got up and we moved and we danced and we did this. I'm like, what did you learn? And she's like, I don't remember. But like this year, like God bless them, like that's all that she's been doing is brain breaks. So I'm like, okay, so the conversation with her is a little bit different from my son. I'm like, so tell me what you actually learned. Like, give me something new that you learned in school today. And she's a little like smart aleck. She's like, you know, Dad, I don't go to school to learn. I go to hang out with my friends. And I'm like, oh, well, that's good to know. So when do you do your learning? She's like, when I come home, I ask my brother because he's older and he's done it before. And so like, I learned from him. I'm like, okay, as long as you got a strategy going there, sweetheart.
Funny.
So, and then it's a little bit different with my older son where, you know, like, it's like, how was your day? And he's like, it was good. Like, he's like shoveling like food in his mouth. I'm like, breathe, slow down, you know, let your mouth finish chewing and your mouth be empty before you pick up the fork for the next spoon. Like before we even finished like the Lord's Prayer, he's like done his meal. Like, it's like, you know, like, I'm like, come on, like it's not going anywhere. But so I've learned with him specifically to say, okay, I want you to name like one high point of your day and name one low point. And so, and the high points come very easily, you know, like, you know, recess or, you know, like, or pickup time or, you know, I did this and that. The low points are the ones where like, kind of, I don't want to talk about them or, you know, maybe there's a bit of a, I don't know if there was ever a low point. I'm like, there's always going to be a low point. Mm. That's okay. That's part of life. That's part of, you know, how we handle these things is important. And we've both educated our children is that our role as parents is not just to kind of like instruct them, but our goal is to help them figure things out because we've done this before. Like nothing under the sun is new, as you know, as they say. But so consult with us, like ask us, like, well, how would you have done it? Would you have done it differently? You know, like, and you have room to make mistakes, but we're here, like we're there, use us as a resource. And so whenever a low point comes up, you know, I'm like, okay, well, how did you handle that particular low point? And so, and it opens up the conversation. And then we kind of like pull the table, if you will, right? Like we're sitting at like at a round table and everybody kind of gives a small little, it's like, oh yeah, you know, I like that approach. That would have been more effective or, you know, so the kids are slowly learning that it's okay to fail and nothing comes out of failure except, you know, how you get up and you go again and you try it again and you do something differently the next time and the result might be different.
So when you do that, you're asking for a high and a low. And then when the low comes, you will ask if they would have done something different in that situation based on what they did do.
Yeah. So like, I always ask him like, what did you do to handle that situation? Right. And he'll tell me. And I said, and was the outcome something that you,
can you give an example without, you know, without divulging his personal life?
Sure. There was one other student that was like recently like moved to the school. Right. He made friends with my son, like became like one of his like best friends, like closest of friends. Like he really like gravitated towards my son and to the exclusion of anybody else. Like he's a little bit on the socially awkward side, like that kid. And at one point, my son started to come home and he is just upset. You can tell, like, I pick up, like, he's just, there's something off about him. Like, there's something. I'm like, buddy, what's going on? He's like, I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to talk about it. Finally, after a week of this, I said, something is bothering you. And we wouldn't be good parents if we didn't figure this out together with you, because nothing is worth you being upset. Nothing is worth this behavior or this mood that you're in. Like, I guarantee you, nothing is worth it. So let's talk it out. What's going on? And he's like, well, this guy, you know, I thought he was my friend, but he's now just being rude. He's like, he's calling me names. He's like, he would, you know, like, steal his, like, water bottle or hide it, and or he would, like, there was, like, name calling that was occurring. I said, well, have you asked him to, like, stop or to discontinue, because it's something that you don't like? And he's like, I've told him that's not how I like to be communicated with, and so for him to stop, but he's not stopping. And I said, so what's the next step? And he's like, I don't know. Like, so my son is also in martial arts. And I'm like, did you maybe accidentally, you know, rib check him? Or, and he's like, Dad, I would get into trouble. I would get, like, suspended from the school for, like, violence, but I know I could, like, drop him, like, you know? And I said, accidents happen, you know, you can bump into him, you know? And he's like, I don't know if that's going to work. I said, so, okay, what would you do? What would be a logical next step? And I said, because this seems like at your level, it's not working. So what's the next point of escalation? And he's like, I think I could probably talk to the teacher. I said, okay, go talk to your teacher. Do you want me to, do you want either of us to come with you to talk to the teacher? And he's like, no, I'll go talk to him. I've got a good rapport with the homeroom teacher. And for the first year, it's a man, it's good for my son. And so he went and spoke to him. And then the teacher's like, you know, I have noticed a change in behavior from the other guy. And he's like, I think he's really, like, really wanting to hold on to your friendship as hard as he possibly can. And he thinks that teasing is one way of, like, kind of like the next step in the friendship almost. But he's really not comprehending that this is hurtful behavior. This is not something that you appreciate or whatever. He's like, I'll talk to him. So he went and talked to him. And the kid unfortunately didn't quite get the situation. So my son came back and he's like, nothing has changed. I said, okay, I think it's time for me to go and talk to your teacher if that's okay with you. And he's like, you know what? I feel free. I wasn't gonna step or before he gave me that permission to kind of, like, go. And I simply went and spoke to the teacher and I said, this clearly has to stop because my son is not having a good time at school. So whatever you're going to do on your end to make sure that it stops, like, I'm going to leave it up to you. But otherwise, my next, you know, step is either to talk to the principal or to talk to his family directly. And he's like, no, I'll talk to his parents. And so the teacher did, and he talked to the parents. And on our end, I said to my son, I said, you don't have to be friends with everybody. At this point, you can just push him aside and avoid him. You have plenty of other friends. He's like, but he has no other friends except for me. And so that was his motivation to kind of remain. That I said, do you understand the definition of abuse? As a marriage counselor and a therapist, like, I see, unfortunately, my wife said it perfectly. She says, you see the different shades of evil in so many capacities. Mm-hmm. And this was kind of like a classic case. I'm like, you get isolated from everybody else. And you feel like you can't leave this particular friendship or relationship out of fear that the other person is going to, like, harm themselves or, you know, be lonely or whatever. But in the meantime, you're suffering. So that's classic abuse, my friend. That's not good. That's not healthy. That's going to establish, like, a different pattern for you when you grow up. So you need to be strong enough at this point to say, I've tried everything in my capacity, but the rest is up to him. So he's no longer friends with that guy, and that guy is kind of lonely, and he's trying to reach out to other people now at this point in the school.
Mm-hmm.
So that all was that, a
All that from the dinner conversation.
All that from the dinner conversation. It will never come if I don't have that open dialogue with my kids. If they don't trust me to share these moments with them. If they have never learned that, you know, the world sometimes sucks and we have to behave in a harsher way, in a more definitive way. If they haven't learned that, he would have been in a different.
Yeah. So dinner for you is sort of the open door to have those conversations come to the surface.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There's an Arabic saying, I'm going to kind of loosely translate it, when your son grows up, befriend him. So it's alluding to the idea of the change in the relationship where you're not father and son, you're more of like friends, right? And I've tried to establish that within limits, right? Like my wife has gone to the complete opposite end where she's like their best friend and like whatever. But now the downside of that is that when she wants something or she starts to implement rules, they're like, who are you? You're not dad, right? Like, right? And she gets so mad. She's like, why is it that they listen to you? They don't listen to me. I'm like, because there's a boundary that was, you know, kind of crossed off. I'm like, they still know, even though that I'm their friend, I'm still dad, right? There's an inherent authority to my position that must be adhered at all times.
What is that phrase in Arabic?
So you want me to say it in Arabic?
Yeah.
Or in kabira ibnak akhihu. I think, don't quote me because my Arabic is really bad as well. But as far as I know, that's what it is. But when your son grows up, befriend him, right? And we've kind of got into that sooner than later, right?
Yeah. Did you, when you were having kids, did you think about an age when that would occur, or did you think it would be around this 12?
You know, it's tough to say. I think I didn't have a set age because like they surprise me day in and day out. My kids surprise me. Like, you know, I'm like, you're 12 or you're 9 and you're saying these things or whatever. So their maturity is all dependent on the child. So there's no hard and set, you know, like adolescence is a great time for that. If you wait until you get to this age and you haven't put in the legwork prior to, it's going to be a struggle. It's going to be a challenge, right? Because it's a different behavior, completely different behavior.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. So one of your expertise is the family relationships. That's one of your areas of expertise. Mm-hmm. And tell me a little bit about that, you know, how you got into that and what you would tell someone in this particular situation as they're going from child to adult, that transition, and how they can establish that relationship early on so that when their child grows up, it's not this stranger now that I'm having to meet for the first time, but it's a relationship that's developed into something much deeper and more powerful of a relationship.
It's a fully loaded question.
It was. Sorry, there was a lot in there, wasn't there?
No. So I, prior to being a family therapist, actually, I was a chiropractor. And, you know, I enjoyed holistic, you know, healing and whatnot. And I loved when my patients would get better and their pain would, you know, abate. And I would always have conversations with my patients. And I found that any time that they opened up about their life, the pain going away lasted for longer as opposed to just coming in, get the adjustment and then go about your day. So there was an emotional component to this pain. And that's how I got into psychotherapy in the first place. I'm like,
You're saying that when your patients opened up with you, their pain would go away or it would...
Well, coupled with the adjustment, but it would stay like better for a longer period of time.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay. So their ailment would not come back as soon if you actually got into a deeper conversation about their situation.
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. And so that's what kind of got me intrigued more about like psychotherapy and you know, and I've always been a fan of humanity, if you will. I love hearing people's stories. And then during my practicum or my internship of psychotherapy, I happened to do my placement in a place that specialized in marriage counseling. And so I never thought that would be a niche that I would fall into. And on top of it, it was Christian marriage counseling as well. And so it was a perfect fit. You know, God had a perfect plan for me to end up in that place. And so we talk about family systems in counseling. We talk about rules that we come from our family of origin, as to like, you know, the husband is the head of the house, or, you know, it's a more of an equal marriage, or the explicit rules or the implicit rules of you sleep on the right side of the bed, you sleep on the left side of the bed, like those kind of rules that we have learned and we bring into the marriage. And coupled with the roles of, like, you know, the wife cooks, the husband, you know, goes out to work, or vice versa, or whatever those gender normative roles that we've learned from our childhood, which seem to be kind of like changing and evolving. But again, the whole underlying point here is communication. If things are still on the implicit level or still, you know, below the radar, that's where conflict arises, because we have expectations that my partner is going to be behaving in this particular way, and I don't get that behavior, so that creates problems. Okay, and so anytime any couple comes to my office with that complaint, I'm like, well, did you tell this to your husband? Did you tell this to your wife? Is this an open communication that you've had with your partner? And they're like, I never thought that I would need to like say this. It just seems so intuitive. Like, it's just like, it's something. And I always tell the toothpaste story that almost broke my marriage in the first year. And it was the idea of one of us squeezes the toothpaste from the middle and the other one squeezes the toothpaste from the end. And we're both like strong, opinionated humans. And we're like, you know, what's wrong with you? You don't know how to do this. There's something off about you, and I never should have married you. And it was big escalation of things. And I'm like, listen, that's just how I learned how to do it. Like, this is, and that's how, just how I learned how to do it. So 15 years later into our marriage, we each have our own toothpaste.
problem solved.
That's the resolution that we came to. But again, it was just and what works for us is not going to work for another couple. They're going to have to like duke it out until somebody caves in to whatever way of squeezing the toothpaste, you know, like, or squeezing in the middle and then pushing it. I don't know, whatever. But that's the whole point, is about communication. And everything to be communicated explicitly and overtly, and to say, let's talk about it. There's nothing that is beyond conversation. Nothing. There's nothing that remains to be hidden, right? So let's talk about it. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about it.
No, that's really good. I know that even for myself, you know, my wife and I have been having conversations now. We've been married for 18 years. We've been having conversations this week related to things that we learned from our parents when we lived with them as teenagers, mm-hmm. and what are the expectations of a husband and wife? What are the expectations of the roles, as you mentioned, yeah. and all these things that seem so obvious to oneself? Like, of course, this is the way you would do it. Of course you do it like this. And when you start asking the question, why,
yep.
you realize the why is because that's what I saw.
Exactly.
And that's pretty much the only reason.
That is the only reason. You're absolutely right. And you are, how did you put it?
You only know the dad you grew up with.
That's the one. And I want to touch on that. That's a very important point, Tim, because today's world, like, as fathers, we need to be very emotionally intelligent, right? It's something that our fathers didn't necessarily grow up with, and they handed us the best that they knew. But unfortunately, the strategies that perhaps they used in the past are not necessarily effective in today's world, mm-hmm. right? Like, I'm gonna kind of very loosely. I have a client, a young university guy who is struggling. He's in for individual counseling, and he's struggling in a relationship that he's in. And the relationship issues is he doesn't know how to navigate the roles appropriately in that relationship. And the first question that I asked, I said, tell me about your father and how him and your mother interact. But it turns out that the father is, for lack of a better term, a dictator who is actively trying to teach his son that level of control. He's like, you need to be in control of the finances. You need to be in control of the rhetoric. You need to be in control of the schedule. You need to be in control of X, Y, and Z. Because the second that you let go of that control, she's going to walk all over. And the problem that this guy is having is that that's not his personality. He's very much about that equality and that Christ-like servant leadership where he's, you know, like from Ephesians where, you know, where, you know, like love, like husbands, love your wives, just as Christ, like loved the church and gave himself up for her. That's the mentality that he wants to live his life. And so there's that, the problem is not the girlfriend, the problem is the dad, right? And so it's the strategies that our fathers necessarily kind of grew up with are no longer concurrent, right? And unfortunately, at times, are not Christian.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because that particular situation, it's usually that the dad passes things on that he's not trying to pass on. It's just how he lives. Mm-hmm. And in this case, it's he does know what he's teaching and he feels like it's right and that his son should take this approach, which is maybe in some ways it makes it easier to identify because he's saying it out loud.
Yeah.
But maybe it doesn't make it any more easy to alter what one has seen their whole life.
Yeah. 100%. And that kind of seems to be the struggle for that young man, because he's like, how do I navigate wanting to live that way while still my father is, you know, kind of whispering in my ear constantly this and this and this and this and that. Yeah. He's like, I know it's going to seep in. I understand. And I'm sure I'm going to like try something like to come close to that.
Mm.
So
what would you recommend for someone? You mentioned communication as one very important aspect of moving, of understanding the interaction between individuals in relationship with one another. So husband, wife, parents, children, for those kinds of things, for a man who has the memories and teachings of his father stirring in his mind, whether known or unknown, but they're there. How do you walk a man through that?
So self-awareness is the first step, right? Identify what is yours and what is your father's, or what comes from them. Being able to differentiate the two, like, this is how I'm thinking. Is this my own thought, or is this coming something that I've learned from my childhood? And is it applicable here today? Is it effective? Right?
Now, do you have a process, or is it journaling, or is there some kind of way that men would walk through something like this?
So first and foremost, I always get people to do a personality assessment, right? Just a very simple, like whatever is at hand, whether it's dope, whether it's MBTI, whatever personality assessment you can get your hands on is a great start. That kind of gets the balls. I was like, well, okay, well, this tells me that this is important for me and this is not. Start engaging with that. Is that true? Is that not true? Is that something that is important to me and I've learned to let go of because of my life circumstances? So start to engage from that perspective. That's the very first step. And then listening. Listening is a big key, right? In the art of communication, if you will. We don't know how to listen. We listen to respond, right? But I always talk about active listening as the point of it is to listen, to understand. So that would be it. First, do a personality assessment, figure out who you are. And from there, you'll be able to identify the stuff that you learned versus the stuff that's true to you and see how you navigate the two together, which one is good and which one's not.
That's a great step forward. That's I would love to hear a little bit about your own practice and how people can connect with you.
So I practice in the GTA. I do a lot of couples work, marriage work, strong marriage work. And then I also do executive coaching, funny enough, completely unrelated side of it, but I, you know, targeting the family life as well as the professional life.
Yeah. You work in person and virtually?
So yes, I work, there's a couple of offices that I work in person. There's one that's called Cornerstone, and that's in Mississauga, and you can just Cornerstone Family Counseling Services. You can look that up. There's also El Piso, which is in a different part of the GTA called, in a place called Milton. And then the virtual. And for the virtual, you can connect with me via LinkedIn, or you can connect with me via Psychology Today. It's psychologytoday.com, and you can find my name is Yusuf Farag, would be on there. Those are the best places to get hold of me.
Awesome. That's great. Yusuf, thanks so much for all your time today. I really appreciate it. And I want to, you know, wish you the best in your own fathering journey. And I hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you very much, Tim. It was a pleasure talking to you as well.
Fellow fathers and friends, so glad you could join us for this episode. To stay connected, visit our website at fatherandfriend.com. Sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and other social media sites. Be sure to like, follow, and share with fellow dads and families in your community. If you have a topic you'd like us to discuss, send us a message and let us know. Until our next episode, keep showing up, loving deeply, and making an impact for the good of your family. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Father and Friend.